That's blues harmonica virtuoso, singer and songwriter James Cotton with Blues in My Sleep. You know, the condition we all seem to be suffering from. Dave Maxwell on piano, Joe Louis Walker on guitar, Charlie Hayden on bass. It's from his 1996 album, Deep in the Blues. Born in Tunica, Mississippi, Cotton was a contemporary of blues greats Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. He died in March of this year in Austin, Texas, at the age of 81. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And my goodness, it seems as if we should start our programs on Tuesdays, because Mondays is just too much happening over the weekend. And giving us a ton of news to react to on Monday mornings. Well, first thing we should know is that it looks like the White House is going to be endorsing Doug Jones, who is a Republican challenger of Roy Moore, the man we've been talking about a lot, for his seat. So that's one thing that should set you up. It's amazing. And secondly, we have President Robert Mugabe refusing to exit stage left. He's vowing to stay on. And so his party, which had basically terminated his membership over the weekend, is now looking to begin impeachment proceedings. And by the way, we'll be talking in greater detail about Mugabe on Wednesday with Dr. Gerald Horn, and we'll be discussing some other related issues as well. Well, over the weekend, thousands of people marched on the National Mall of the nation's capital yesterday, demanding that President Trump and his administration deliver promised help for the storm-ravaged island of Puerto Rico. And as you know, this has been an ongoing problem, an ongoing itchy situation. In addition, the coalition of humanitarian and activist organizations that staged the march is calling for legislative action on eliminating an unfair maritime law that imposes prohibitive taxes on imports, cancellation of the island's $73 billion debt burden, and rebuilding critical infrastructure. 2 months after Hurricane Maria gutted most of Puerto Rico, the island's residents remain despondent about their living conditions. Does the U.S. really intend to restore Puerto Rico, or is there another plan? That's the first of two subjects I'll be talking about today. In talking about Puerto Rico, even before the storm, the hurricane, I talked about the fact of Puerto Rico in so many ways serving as an ongoing lesson in second-class citizenship. The island, which has a unique history, one replete with colonialism, imperialism, and never ever encouraged actually to just spin off. There are countries smaller than the size of Puerto Rico that are independent, but it is not to be. It seems that it is designed that Puerto Rico forever will be in the clutches of the United States. It's been held hostage these many years. And now, of course, as you remember, when Hurricane Maria struck, and we saw the extent of the destruction. And now, 2 months later, people are still without water, drinkable water. People are still looking for federal aid. We saw a story not too long ago of what was described as aid. When people opened some of these aid packages, there were things like Skittles and silly items in there that have nothing to do with sustaining life. There's no reason that Puerto Rico should be still under such duress just to get through one day after the other. It isn't as if the Latino legislators and African-American legislators and other legislators, it isn't as if they totally ignore Puerto Rico. They have been carrying the message to the administration. The administration just simply doesn't particularly see this as an urgent matter. So I've said about Puerto Rico that the storm would hasten another set of agendas that have nothing to do with Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans. And I did say that Puerto Rico, right after this hurricane, would be a moneymaker for a whole bunch of people. We saw what recently happened with the contract for restoring the electrical grid. A little company with two principals out of Montana winning a contract of $300 million plus. Two people. And of course they say, well, we'll hire the people we need, but that's not the point, is it? The point is, in their current capacity, they're totally incapable of handling a job this size, no matter how many people they say they'll hire. The fact is, as a company, they don't have the capacity to deliver that. And we saw immediately the nasty business of corruption rearing its ugly head. Let's go to Puerto Rico and make money. But I believe it is a pervasive thought. And sooner or later, we will see people kind of working in concert to do what they've been planning to do all along, which is to chase everybody off the island, have the island all to themselves, or just designate a small portion of the island for the hardy residents to live. But Puerto Rico has already been spoken for. And we have to realize that the fight is beyond the business of aid. This is about the land being stolen. This is about heredity, cultural heredity, being stolen. We will have, as we already saw, I've been talking about it, even before the storm, and I was exasperated that in the matters that I was talking about, we did not see any participation from the Puerto Rican community. And that is the carving up of Puerto Rico. Exactly what happened in Detroit. First, you take a city that had a history of thriving, as did Puerto Rico, irrespective of, we know that they were living under colonialism and then imperialism, which is pretty much the same thing. But people were able to hold on to their land, which is the basis of all nationhood. Dr. John Henrik Clark taught me that. The basis of all nationhood is land. And this is exactly what is imperiled. The storm did a fantastic thing of making it possible to remove the focus on what we really ought to be focusing on is what is happening to the land. And with so much accelerated exodus from Puerto Rico because of Maria, people are being encouraged to leave. There is a veritable exodus in places like Tampa. They're coming to Tampa, New York, where there are significant Puerto Rican populations right now. Excuse me. So the island under the veneer that things are so hard, relatives are trying to accommodate them and so forth, but they're leaving the land, as is understandable. I'm mentioning it because it is part of the program. To get them so frustrated, living without water, potable water, living without incomes, living without a decent meal every day. These conditions, these deplorable conditions, would tend to aggravate people to the point where they just pack up and go, which is exactly what is happening now. Get them frustrated and angry, make them suffer to the point where anything but there is preferable. So we're seeing this exodus, a massive exodus of Puerto Ricans from Puerto Rico to the mainland. Pretty soon it will have a rippling effect because the cities to which they're migrating, clearly out of a need, an evident need, there's nothing there to maintain life every day. So in coming to places, as I said, like Orlando and New York City, we will next hear about the aggravating circumstances of this mass migration. They will require housing. They will require jobs. They will require a decent standard of living. And this is now going to create a new set of problems because the help that Puerto Rico should have had by now did not arrive and will not arrive. So technically, you could say that Puerto Ricans right now are refugees in their own land. They are Americans. And they have to flee their land of birth, to which they are accustomed living. They have family ties there, but most importantly, many of them own land. And that is the important focus. I don't want people to lose focus of that. The real estate industry understands this because before the storm, long before the storms, they had begun to organize themselves to force the courts to give them as much leeway as possible to claim the land. I talked about it the day they were in court. A federal court has already begun the phase of deciding how much will be given to whom in exchange for what. The real estate industry loves the idea that the island has been gutted And if people decide to stay, it will be because they intend willingly to suffer such hardship. But their vision of Puerto Rico, the new Puerto Rico, will be a Puerto Rico absent of Puerto Ricans. You cannot go home again. So they are taking over sizable portions of Puerto Rico as a way of saying, well, Puerto Rico went bankrupt and the debts have to be paid. Wall Street zooms in. We have a plan already to accommodate that. We know how to fix that. Puerto Rico can settle its $73 billion debt by giving us the land and the real estate in exchange. Plain and simple. This is not complicated. They already are at stage two. And it rankled me that both, when they had hearings both in San Juan, in federal court in San Juan, and in federal court in New York City, there were no Puerto Ricans there. Which says either they don't know how these things are happening or when these things are happening, or this is part of the secret pact that interested parties are now congealing. They're putting it all together. And they will all get what they want out of Puerto Rico, which we are told now is in such terrible state. You know, you can't, it's going to take so long to fix. There are so many problems. How is it possible to fix Puerto Rico? You just can't fix it. But there are people who said already months and years ago, they said they have a formula for fixing Puerto Rico. And that is just take it. I also suspect that that includes the U.S. military, the U.S. government. Puerto Rico, when you look at the map, you see how well situated Puerto Rico is with respect to the total Caribbean basin. Geographically, it is a desirable place for military operations to be set up. You have total command of the Caribbean and Central and South America. So instead of having your warships having to trek X number of hundred miles extra to get to wherever it is they're going to go bomb people, you can just have a military installation in Puerto Rico. Or you can make Puerto Rico the next Guantanamo Bay. People, young people from the United States with a little bit of money had already begun migrating to Puerto Rico because they anticipate a nice life at a lower cost. They tended to be in the technical industries. And as you see, applying the old emptying methods that we have seen all over the United States in communities that once were thought of as being just useless. Just throw them away, you know, write them off. Use them to store warehouses. But we see the resurgence with a viciousness we haven't seen before. You can't buy a house now in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Well, they're now calling parts of it Stuyvesant Heights. You want to buy a house in Harlem now, you better look at least $4 million. So this is what I think is being planned for Puerto Rico. You delay the services because in any event, you have such disdain for people of color, I'm talking about the administration now, that it doesn't matter even if they get help. You just say it in a press release, we're sending help. They open the boxes, there's Malamars and Skittles and silly things that nobody in their right mind would send to a population under such duress unless they don't like them or unless they are so disgusting as individuals and human beings and lying to the people who are thinking the government is, you know, going to keep its word. You denigrate the mayor of San Juan and you make her look like she's a Looney Tune. And you treat the population of Puerto Rico generally as an unwanted presence, although these are fellow Americans. And it should be a source of outrage every day in Congress that this president gets away with this, that FEMA gets away with this, that the contractors who have been hired and making a ton of money over the misery, the daily misery of Puerto Ricans are getting away with this. But we have to be very much aware of what it looks like the program is. Frustrate them into leaving the country. Retake the land. This is the most important thing that they have to understand. This is the real fight here. The fight is over the land. And they have already begun to put into place ways to take the land, never again to be claimed by any Puerto Rican. In that way, what you have is the destruction of any possibility of setting up a homeland, a true homeland. You're not going to have it. They will get you out by every means necessary, frustrate you, anger you, deny you everything that could possibly be done to compel you to come to the inevitable conclusion that you no longer can live in Puerto Rico. Now, this is a country that has poured billions of dollars, given billions of dollars every single year to Israel, to help them build houses, help them break the law, international law, to build into areas that they're supposed to be forbidden to build. And they get that money off the top. They don't get that money in increments. Hundreds of billions of dollars a year, including from the taxpayers paying citizens of Puerto Rico. Their money has been going to Israel for every year to provide housing, provide health, provide food, provide schools and education, all the things that Puerto Ricans do not have today in their own land. Israel gets that off the top. in one lump sum. They are not working by the installment plan. They do not have to hear any excuses as to why people who are suffering can't get relief. Americans who are suffering can't get relief. They're not begging and pleading for relief. So much for America first. A whole island, more than 3 million people, have become the wanderers of the world. Why? Because there was a nasty hurricane. Okay. You think that people can't overcome after being subjected to a hurricane? Life goes on. So we need to put some pressure on those who pretend to represent us, all of us, because this is a thing that we should all be angry about and all concerned about, and demand that if Puerto Rico can't be fixed, then aid to Israel, humanitarian aid to Israel, which is used in part also to wage war against their neighbors and even some of their own people. It should stop. Just on the basis of that loan. Every single year you could meet that obligation that you have placed on yourself, because the United States has no reason to commit as part of its domestic budget the allocation of U.S. taxpayer dollars, to fund projects in a country that is breaking the law, breaking international law, defying people, saying, you can't tell us what to do. We will use your American dollars to suppress Palestinians and people who are emigrating into Israel. And we're going to do what we want with your 93 plus billions of dollars that we get free money. We will buy tanks, not food. We'll buy missiles, a missile defense system, not schools for children. The money that the United States gives to Israel every year can substantially restore Puerto Rico in no time. The benefits will be people will be employed, rebuilding their country, rebuilding their island, I should say. They will stay where they want to stay. Their families will once more be intact. An infrastructure will be able to support essential needs like running water and electricity. Well, I'll take this break. I'll come back to part two right after that. listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. City Councilwoman LaToya Cantrell, who earned her political stripes as a community organizer and activist, fighting efforts to totally wipe out the neighborhood of Broadmoor after Hurricane Katrina, is the new mayor, the first African-American woman at that, of New Orleans. And that is interesting how the world connects. I just talked about the possibilities that are not seen for Puerto Rico, and how after the hurricane, the desire to totally empty the island, get everybody out. Here is the environment out of which Councilwoman and now Mayor LaToya Cantrell comes. How small the world is. How well connected we are, and we don't even recognize it. What I want to talk about, I don't know the councilwoman, now mayor. I do not know the new mayor of New Orleans. But I found something very significant about her election. And that is that her political career, if you want to use the word, is rooted in community activism. And people remember that. She was fighting very hard for this community that they wanted to just write off the map. And she ran as a Democrat. And that is where I'm going with my little commentary today. She was supported in her efforts. This was very significant. She was supported by other parties, not just the Democratic Party. But she had the Working Families Party endorsing her and supporting her. She had the Step Up Louisiana Party, not party, but a movement. She had other small parties and movements, including Bernie Sanders' movement, Our Revolution, supported her. Indivisible, another such organization similar to Our Revolution, got behind her. So it isn't a stretch to say that, although, of course, being a Democrat, she was very visible as a Democrat, but we can't discount the fact that these other movements kicked in significantly and contributed to her victory. Now, where am I going, you ask? I'm hearing you. I'm saying, I'm very happy that these movements, these new movements, third party movements, however we want to call them, were very instrumental in her election. Why then didn't we have a representative of, say, the Green Party or Bernie Sanders' movement actually run? That might have persuaded her to run outside of the Democratic Party. Because, as you know, the Democratic Party in Louisiana is nothing to boast about. It has a dreadful reputation for corruption and for basically working against the interests of the people. So even though she was elected, and you have to be elected running under some kind of party banner, she still is in the pit with the vipers. hopefully she could stand up and withstand, you know, the taint and the stench that the Democratic Party will inevitably bring. I'm going to the point that we see so many opportunities in which third-party movements, such as Bernie Sanders, such as the Green Party, such as the Working Families Party, which, by the way, also supported her, it is time now for these parties to grow up and make their foray into the political world full-fledged. You know, move beyond supporting actor and be part of a new breed of actors operating fully within their construct, their political and philosophical construct, and bringing to fruition a brand new political day. The potential is there. It always has been there. I would say boldly, there is no way that Barack Obama could have won his two terms without the support of the grassroots. There's no way. What the grassroots needs to do now is to affirm themselves as political entities outside of the Democratic Party's reach. Because make no mistake, as popular as Ms. Cantrell apparently was, as much as she has done for the community to inspire people to support her, she's still within the clutches of the Democratic Party. And at some point, she's going to have to face a very nasty truth, and that is that her political survival will depend on her loyalty to party as opposed to people. At some point, it's going to happen. She may be strong enough to overcome it, but it is inevitable that that's where she's going to end up. I see a missed opportunity here because I think in so many of these races where we see people striking out from the epicenter, the actual core of the party, they still have enough clout outside of the party that boosted them to prominence and boosted them to victory. Well, my point is, why aren't we seeing the byproducts of these movements and parties themselves running? What prevented in this election? What prevented the rise of a Working Families Party mayor? I'm very happy to know that she had that kind of support. I'm saying now we have to move aggressively to grow leadership within the context of new parties. Get away from the duopoly. They're no good. They're both wings of a flightless bird. So the time should be to be aggressive about that, because we see the real impact. This is not imagined. Votes did come from these sources outside of the Democratic Party. And like I say, you have to run under some kind of political banner. She evidently didn't have a banner to run under. And that's the next step for these parties or movements. And that's the barometer by which we should measure their seriousness or not. You've been an also-ran for too many years now. It is time, because we continue to see the evidence. It's there. People who identify with what it is you're saying, people you cultivate. It was said that Cantrell was one of the hardest campaigners you could find, knocking on doors night and day, day and night. Took on an entrenched system and managed, even running under its banner, managed to succeed. This is amazing. It's a lesson. Are we even aware of it, that it's a lesson? I make my umpteenth plea to these parties and movements to get serious. You can see how vital your input was in this particular election, but beyond it, people who were voting as Democrats, they were forced to vote as Democrats because the presence of these parties and independent movements had not yet reached a point of critical mass to give people the belief, give them the assurance that this is a growing thing. This is moving. We have plans. We do not intend to be an afterthought of the Democratic Party, nor an appendage of the Democratic Party. We are sufficiently powerful to strike out on our own, having a way of participating in all these races, but independently of the duopoly. So she's to be congratulated, did a great job, and again, building on work she had already begun to do. Defending the community, speaking up for the community, being present in the community and accessible to the community, and seeing to the community's interests. It paid off. It paid off. Now, I wish I could convince these parties to come together in strategy sessions, because we have seen the influence of these smaller movements and parties, individual parties, third parties, as we would call them, having an effect in races across the country. They helped to elect a mayor in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi. They helped elect officers and elected officials in Birmingham, Alabama, and some parts of Atlanta, I believe. We also saw a couple of new additions to the political entity, not because Democrats voted. We have to understand that many people described as Democrats who voted are really third-party people who have no place else to go. So they're described as Democrats. They go under the tent of the Democrats. They have no vehicle to convey them to victory. And that is because these parties are not making the fullest effort at strategy, at planning, and at taking on the political system in a smart way, giving people choices. And you see the end result. These achievements, I would argue, are Because we have some people who are forced. They are forced to make a choice, and they're making a choice only because there is no to, a choice to go with the Democratic Party, that is, only because there's nothing else that comes close in play. So the fact that these parties are not doing what they need to do, being in the community, talking to people, registering people, you have a plan to end up on the ballot. These are the things that they ought to do. This is their job. And again, I'm very happy that they were able and smart enough to side with this young lady. And she is young. She's only in her 40s. She's about 45. And that says quite a bit. She has a lot of work to ahead of her. But it was good that while people supported her as a Democrat, the instruction inherent in her victory is that those parties that played a role, a very significant role in getting her elected, should now move to the next level of activism and form full-fledged parties able to compete on an equal basis with any other party, able to elect people. That's the task right now. I have a couple of minutes, and if you care to call at 888-874-4888. Of course, we will return after Thanksgiving. We are not on live on Thanksgiving Day, which is Thursday. But on Friday, when we return to our regular Free Your Mind session, we could continue the conversation then. But there is some time now. I have a couple of minutes available at 888-874-4888. These are the things that we ought to be thinking about, and more so, what we ought to be doing something about. And not stop and say, well, you know, you could stop for about 3 minutes and say, we won a victory. But as of minute four, you are fully engaged in a plan, an absolute plan. And we have to take this seriously if we mean to progress in any way. I cannot believe that the entire island of Puerto Rico is totally defenseless. I'm not saying that people aren't supporting Puerto Rico. They are. But not in the way that it counts, because they're not present there to make that difference. Jay from New York, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice. In regards to Puerto Rico, I have a friend of mine whose mother, you know, retired from New York City Transit, who I also worked with. And she went back to Puerto Rico, bought a, you know, home and everything, and with this tragedy, has now been forced back to come to New York, man, and she's having a real hard time. She's basically wanting to give up on life. You know, they got her in counseling and everything. You know, it's just absolutely sad. And it seems as though, in all honesty, America isn't going to do absolutely anything to rectify that situation in regarding to building for the Puerto Rican people and making their lives whole again. It seems as though that what's going to happen is they're just basically going to turn that into a playground for the rich. And the people that don't have any type of assets or wealth are the ones who are stuck there in absolute horrid conditions. And, you know, it's absolutely sad. And it's deplorable that, you know, we would even be involved as a country in something of that nature. I mean, this woman who I've known had worked for close to 30-some years, had the opportunity to retire, bought her a beautiful home, you know what I mean, had a garden and everything. You know, her family was able to come down during the holidays, during the summer, and just enjoy it, you know. And, you know, the incident happened, and it absolutely, you know, basically wiped her out. And, you know, when she tried to get some sort of help from FEMA and others, they basically given her the runaround. And in regards to the insurance, she's having problems with them, just like the people in Katrina did. And, you know, her will for life is just diminishing, you know, and her son is now having her, you know, go through counseling and all of that. And it's affecting him.
It is a tragedy. It is a tragedy.
It's beyond
what is
a
happening.
Tragedy.
But think of it this way. You're talking about one individual. Imagine how you ought to be thinking about more than 3 million people.
Oh, I am. I'm just using that as an example.
I know you are. I'm saying generally, if you can see up close the magnitude of the impact this is having on one person, imagine what's going on with more than 3 million people. Thank you so much for your call today. Shirley from Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Utrice. The information is invaluable. We couldn't purchase it. You have compared Puerto Rico along with Detroit, Michigan, and I think very well. It's so deep. And then you threw in New Orleans, Louisiana, I guess it is, and that's deep too, because you have all these different people coming in, voting in Detroit, voting in other places, and you get these racists who are now involved in Detroit, and they are actually trying to take over the city, talking about it's their city, and ignoring the people who are the actual true citizens of the city. I had an experience myself with one of them, and his wife had to hold him back. He was actually vicious toward me, talking about the city belonged to him. This is a white guy, and I'm a black woman. And he was disgusting. And so we need to know this type of stuff, because many of them are not smart enough. I'm not smart enough either to know what you know. So I want to say thank you again very much for that.
Thank you, and I'm glad that you tuned in today. Thanks so much.
Always.
Khalil from South Carolina, you have a smidgen of time.
Yeah, good afternoon, Sister Utrice. Good afternoon, my PR and family. I'm so happy to hear what that your young lady has done. And I'm saying we could do that on a national level through PRN, because we already have the medium. You know what I'm saying? By the way, I want to put this out, you, Sister Utis Lead is the new Black Hitler number two. You heard it first on PRN. I'm not telling you. You're going to hear this, and the assault and the attack. This is second time it's happening, because you were attacked when you were in NBI. When you speak truth, you are anti, you know what, and homophobic, racist, you name it. How do we defend and protect you and Brother Gary? That's my little take.
We're doing all right? Okay, believe it. I don't want to presume to speak for Gary, but he's doing all right. And I'm doing okay. And we're both doing the work we love to do. And that's what matters to me. Doing the work that I love to do, and this is it.
I know you're doing the work, and everybody in PRN. You know what was this very disturbing for me was Michael Parenti. He's no longer on the air. Why? simply because we are not doing our work. You know, all you have to do is share the information. That's all we have to do because we're privileged to know and the truth. And that's all people need to know. Once they begin to know, then we could operate from there. I mean, y'all could, within that station, could teach us because, you know, we ain't got no sense. So y'all could guide us. We'll do whatever you all say. All right?
Well, thank you, Willie. Great to hear from you. And thanks so much for your very kind thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Okay, here's the number two.
That brings us to the end of the program. I thank you for listening. And let's continue to be in communion with each other. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. A great program. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.